Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, Housing Crash Belting County Revenues. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the dateline of Raleigh. A double-digit decline in housing prices across the state and Triangle since 2008 is continuing to play havoc with county tax bases, and the problem appears to be getting worse. The selling prices of homes and other real property in 66 of the state's 100 counties, including the Triangle counties of Durham, Orange, and Wake, have slipped below the assessed tax values according to the latest data from the North Carolina Department of Revenue. In Wake County, homes are selling on average at 10% below tax value. In 2011, the figure was 6% under. In Durham County, they're selling at 6% below tax value. And in Orange County, the number is 5% below. What's unprecedented, say observers, is the sheer number of counties where the situation holds true in the face of an average 12% housing price slump across the state since 2008. It's astounding, says Todd McGee of the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners. In the past, we might have one or two counties that were like this. Now it seems to be getting astronomical. Why all this matters is that over time, as counties go through property revaluations, they'll pick up the lower selling prices in revaluation exams, ultimately cutting their tax bases. That, in turn, would lead county officials to face the unenviable choice of seeking higher property taxes or slashing services. County property tax revaluations put a value on any home by looking at comparable sales during the previous 3 years. New Hanover County revalued in 2012, and its tax base shrank by 16%, says UNC Chapel Hill School of Government professor Chris McLaughlin, who recently blogged on the latest housing price tax data. Meanwhile, in Cabarrus and Rutherford counties, the base shrinkage hit 10%. In normal times following revaluations with tax bases growing by 20% or more, counties are able to cut the tax rates they impose in so-called revenue-neutral actions. Some 13 North Carolina counties revalued last year. In 9 of those cases, the new revenue-neutral tax rate was higher than the previous rate due to eroding property values. Counties in which that happened included Cabarrus, Guilford, and Pitt. Counties and towns that experience shrinking tax bases will need to dramatically reduce their expenses or raise tax rates to account for the lost revenue, says McLaughlin. Case in point, Carteret County raised its property tax rate by 30% last year in recognition of its new, smaller tax base. Wake and Durham counties, which revalued in 2007 for the 2008 tax year, aren't required to do so again until 2015 to 2016. Orange County did it in 2009 and under normal scheduling would do it again in 2013. Orange County Tax Administrator Paul Lawton says, however, that the decision was made to postpone the next revaluation until 2015, in large part due to the lack of sales volume in the Orange County housing market. We just didn't think the sales data was there to justify it, he says. In 2011, housing in Orange County was selling slightly ahead of tax value, only to reverse itself in 2012, falling to 5% below assessed value. The county's tax base, 85% of which is based on housing as opposed to commercial structures, rose by 0.9% over the past year. That is essentially flat, says Lawton. And moving down the page, our next article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, written by Jason DeBrun with the dateline of Raleigh. And this article runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, Jordy's Signing Creates Bump in Ticket Sales. And underneath the article, there's a picture of Jordy wearing his jersey. And the caption reads, Jordan Stahl will join his brother Eric on the ice with the Hurricanes this season. The ticket sales office for the Carolina Hurricanes has been humming this month, thanks in large part to the signing of star forward Jordan Stahl. The hockey club is averse to spilling precise numbers, but at this year's State of the Canes event on July 20, General Manager Jim Rutherford said season ticket sales were the highest since the team moved to Raleigh. The biggest uptick has come since June 22, when the Canes acquired Stahl, younger brother of team captain Eric Stahl. Full season tickets are at the highest level ever for us, Rutherford said in an interview. He credits two reasons, one of course being the stall acquisition, but the other because of an added perk. This year, season ticket holders will receive food, beverage, and merchandise credits that go along with the seat they purchase. First of all, he's, Stahl, obviously an all-star player, says Abel Zalkberg, a co-founder of furniture distributor OFM Incorporated, based in Holly Springs, and a minority owner of the team. I think he's going to raise the bar for quite a few of our players. He's a hard worker. Not only will he benefit the team on the ice, but in ticket sales as well. That was certainly one of the biggest trades of the offseason, Zalkberg says. It certainly puts us in a different position. I think more fans know about the Carolina Hurricanes today. Last year, team majority owner Pete Karmanos raised $19.5 million from a group of local investors, including Zalkberg. Looking ahead, Rutherford says he will just continue to work on possibly adding another player, though could not guarantee that would happen. Increased ticket sales would come as a welcome change for the Canes, who have seen attendance decrease in the past few years. Last year, 657,747 fans came to the 41 home games, an average of 16,043 per game, or only 86% of capacity. By contrast, 19 teams had capacity of at least 98% last year, with the Chicago Blackhawks actually reporting capacity of 105% for the year, the highest in the league, according to data compiled by Sports Business Journal, a sister publication. Considered another way, the Canes hit 98% capacity for only 9 games in each of the past 2 seasons, the 7th worst total in the league in that time span. The Canes acquired 23-year-old Jordan Stahl on June 22 and signed him to a 10-year deal that will pay him $6 million per year. Although he is young, Stahl has already posted some impressive numbers in 6 NHL seasons with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Not only does he already have 120 goals and 128 assists in the regular season, but 23 goals and 13 assists in 73 playoff games as well. He was the 2nd overall pick in the 2006 draft. With the addition of Jordan Stahl and the momentum that is building under Coach Mueller, I think the excitement and anticipation levels leading up to the start of the hurricane season will be as high as they've been since the fall of 2006 and perhaps even higher, says Scott Dupree, Vice President for Sports Marketing with the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. Forbes magazine gives the Canes a value of right at $170 million. Though Karmanos has long said he thinks the team has a higher value than what Forbes estimates on an annual basis. In July, the Centennial Authority, an appointed board that serves as the landlord to PNC Arena, committed $300,000 to locker room upgrades for the Hurricanes. It sorely needs work, Authority Chairman Tom McCormick said at the time. What we have is not fitting of what a professional sports team needs. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Crescent loads up executive suite in multiple hirings. Crescent State Bank, now in the hands of Scott Custer's Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, is beefing up its management team in one fell swoop, bringing in 5 executives with a combined 100 years plus of banking experience. All have specialized expertise in areas of commercial and mortgage banking. These individuals clearly see our vision and want to be a part of what we're doing here at Crescent. I could not be more pleased to have each of them on the team, says Chris Moore, Crescent's regional market president for the Raleigh Triangle area. Joining the Crescent team are Larry Clark, a 36-year banking vet, Jay Rissinger, 13 years, beginning with the bank that is now J.P. Morgan Chase and later RBC PNC, Jeff Hendrick, 10 years, including a stint at Raleigh's Capital Bank, Greg Farrell, 28 years, including a stop at RBC PNC, and Chuck Griswold, 30 years, spent entirely at RBC PNC. These are unprecedented times in our industry, and their many years of experience, proven performance, and integrity are exactly what our business clients are looking for in a banking partner, says Steve Jones, president of Crescent. Crescent, with $825 million in total assets, operates 15 offices from Cary to Wilmington. After failed drug trials, Durham-based drug developer TransZyme Incorporated has lost a partner it had hoped would help the company take its drug candidate, Ulimorlin, to market. The partner, Amsterdam-based Norgine BV, ended the license agreement, and the gastrointestinal treatment drug is in limbo for the time being. After disappointing trial results, the companies announced in March that they would call off development. TransZyme does not incur early termination penalties, and all the rights for the drug revert back to its shareholders. TransZyme stock, which trades under the ticker symbol TZYM, did not see a major hit on this bit of news. It lost nearly half of its value when the negative results were announced, and investors had already priced that into the value of the company, which has a market capitalization of around $103 million. TransZyme has three other products in development, including one in Phase 2 trials. Thanks to Scotty McCrary's deep voice and all-American visage, Garner is now on the national map, and the town wants to keep up that momentum. The Garner Chamber of Commerce's third Plug in the Future conference, addressing the town's economic prospects, will include presentations on economic forecasts, transportation, infrastructure, and education. The half-day conference will be Thursday, August 9 at the Grand Marquis Ballroom at Prestonwood Country Club from noon until 5 p.m., with reception and dinner to follow. A major topic will be the $6.5 million intersection at Highways 40 and 70 and how it would impact residents and businesses. Social media isn't just a way to friend others. It's a valuable job-seeking tool. But Chris McCrea, a Raleigh-based regional vice president for IT staffers Robert Half Technology, says some of the mistakes job seekers make are obvious. The number one mistake would generally be not being cautious of the photos and content they have out there, he says. A professional photograph on a LinkedIn profile doesn't have to be a shot of you in a suit, and be aware of content your friends post, he says. A clean email address is another necessity. How do I say this? Avoid a license plate email, he says. Be professional in your personal address and avoid jokes and nicknames. Those send off the wrong signals, he says. When McCrea is hiring, he puts more stock in a LinkedIn page than a Facebook profile and notes how many connections the job seeker has. Are they well-versed in utilizing social media, he asks. A study by the National Association of Colleges and Employers indicates that 41% of 2012 college grads use social media to land jobs. That's up from 33% since 2008. A Pittsburgh resident wants to reopen the former Chatham Hospital and turn it into a psychiatric and substance abuse treatment center. The Chatham News reports that Tom Glendinning approached the Siler City Board of Commissioners to propose the idea. He would need to buy the facility from UNC Healthcare, then apply for the proper zoning changes. He says it's something he has wanted to do since before 2008, when similar plans were put on hold because of the economic crash. The hospital would employ as many as 50 people and be privately funded through grants and not state-supported, reports the paper. Brenda Steen, executive director of the Apex Chamber of Commerce, has resigned after 5 years. Chamber officials say Steen is resigning to spend more time with her family. Jeff Hastings, who owns Hastings Farm Supply, will be the interim president. The board of directors has formed a search committee to find a new executive director, Hastings wrote in a note to members. Hastings told Biz that the board was surprised by Steen's decision. The Apex Chamber has more than 530 members. Caleb Lester, a 16-year-old from Chapel Hill, has already accomplished something that most golfers have on their bucket list. He's played the Pebble Beach Golf Links in Monterey County, California, and apparently he played quite well. Lester represented the Triangle in the Nature Valley First Tee Open, along with the local First Tee of the Triangle executive director, T.D. Luton. Lester's partner during the tournament was Cary resident Bobby Clampett. After coming within one stroke of the lead at one point, the pair finished 18th in the tourney. All kids in the First Tee aspire to play in this annual nationally televised tournament, Luton says. This tournament is a showcase for our organization, which provides young people with educational programs designed to promote character development and values through golf. During the tourney, Lester and Luton stayed with Robin Baguette and Michelle Fields, who own a vacation home near the 16th hole at the course. Baguette, who used to be the general counsel for the Golden State Warriors, owns the Alpha Omega Winery in Napa Valley. Biz definitely has Pebble Beach on his bucket list. What is it now? Fertilizer first, then the weed killer? Don't fertilize when it's wet, or do fertilize when it's going to rain? Keeping up with the intricacies of maintaining a healthy lawn presents plenty of complexities. Two NC State University students, Ryan Walsh and Daniel Walzer, say that creates a niche for a business: DIY fertilization kits delivered to homes. Ryan is a turf grass science major, and Daniel is studying finance entrepreneurship, so the partnership makes sense, at least on paper. Kits are measured to each lawn, and text messages are sent throughout the year when it is time to apply each product and how to apply it correctly. They call their enterprise Grow Pro Lawn. Contributing to Biz were staffers Lee Weisbecker, Lauren Onsorge, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The next one has the headline, Duke Faces Bumps in Repairing Its Image. This article is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. Corporate governance experts say Duke Energy Corporation should focus relentlessly on forward momentum as it seeks to soothe the anger and distrust that have followed the board's sudden ouster of CEO Bill Johnson. Johnson, several senior executives, and about 11,000 workers became Duke employees on July 2, when the Charlotte-based company merged with Progress Energy, which was based in Raleigh. But three of Johnson's top lieutenants followed him out, and two directors who joined the company's board from Progress have said that they and four colleagues may do the same. Duke director Mary McKee told the North Carolina Utilities Commission last week that she and other directors from Progress had virtually no inkling of trouble until just before the 10-5 vote to sack Johnson. The distrust is understandable, says Dan Fogel, a business professor at Wake Forest University who has served on corporate boards. But Fogel says Duke's board members should respond by reviewing their methods for communicating with one another and with top executives. This constant focus on the past is going to get everybody in more trouble, Fogel says. The company should take control. If people think Duke has its act together, it's going to be in better shape. They're going to say, okay, you have a plan. They really need to consider this a crisis, he adds. The distrust among board members and with regulators was the major factor in Standard & Poor's decision to take Duke's corporate credit rating down a notch to BBB+, three steps above junk status. The move is likely to add substantially to Duke's annual interest costs, which already exceed $1 billion. Duke's lead independent director, Ann Gray, acknowledged last week that the outrage over Johnson's departure had been greater than anyone expected. The response, including the commission's investigation itself, is proving to be a challenge in integrating the two companies. It's been an emotional few weeks for us, says Progress alum Lee Mazzocchi, Duke's chief integration officer, who reports directly to Duke's CEO Jim Rogers. He replaced Paula Sims, who resigned after Johnson's departure. Duke's human resources chief, Jennifer Weber, says that the company has been actively demonstrating to each employee that he or she has a place in the new organization. More than 350 top positions have been determined, with integration proceeding down through lower management levels. Sims and two other top-level executives are the only three of the company's top 80 managers who have left the company since July 2, Weber says. 30 of those 80 come from Progress, Weber says. Rogers and the nine executives who report directly to him have been traveling to Duke facilities in Indiana, Florida, and the Carolinas to meet with managers and employees, she says. A top priority is to get people focused on delivering the promises of this merger, Weber says. Fogel also suggests electing one or two new board members. For one thing, that would help the board move past the Duke Progress divide and the divisive 10-5 vote on July 2. Moreover, Fogel says he believes Duke may need a more sophisticated board now that it's the nation's largest electrical utility. Kent Hughes, managing director of Egan Jones Proxy Services, also calls the Duke board's move highly unusual, but he says he wouldn't necessarily cite it as a reason for shareholders to vote out any of the directors. And some directors from the Progress side may come to understand the decision better, even if they and shareholders now feel schnookered, he says. One has to question how many shareholders would have voted differently, Hugh says, referring to Progress shareholders' 96% vote. in August to approve the merger. Whether that was critical or not, you might get different answers. And moving down the page, we come to an article that has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top third is a picture of a man casually dressed, sitting at a table with some electronics, and the caption reads, "John Austin says selling apps is a challenge with plenty of potential." And then below that, in bright orange lettering, bold, the headline, "Games On. Triangle Whizzes Sniffing the Lure of Developing Apps." And this article was written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. And then also at the bottom of the of this box, there's another picture that looks like it's from a game, a video game. The caption reads, "BitMonster's first game, Lily, is an adventure RPG game and is built using the Unreal Engine 3. A mobile movement is on among local gaming developers, but with a market flooded by low-cost and free apps, how profitable an avenue is an iPhone or an Android for game developers? One of the area's biggest gaming cheerleaders, John Austin, head of what used to be a video game accelerator, Joystick Labs, says mobile games are becoming a tough sell for investors, even as the number of mobile app startups continues to grow. It's challenging to make money in that space, he says. It's a challenge that Emanji Studios took on in the beginning with its Emanji game, among the first 500 offerings when the Apple Store opened in 2008. Founder Keith Shepard relocated the company to Raleigh from Washington, D.C. in May, in part to join the community of independent game developers in the Triangle. Shepard's company is self-funded, and he says it has beat the odds in remaining sustainable. In August, Emanji introduced Temple Run, Brave, a game app that this week recorded more than 100 million downloads at 99 cents each at the Apple App Store, making it the store's fifth best-selling game as of July 25. While the App Store is crowded with more than 350,000 apps available for download, the potential is huge. Forrester Research says annual revenue generated by app sales now stands at about $10 billion and projects it will grow to $38 billion by 2015. Shepard says his company is better off because of the App Store. Before the Apple Store, you could put something on the web, try to sell packaged software, Shepard says. They're very hard. You'd have to set up your own payment process. Apple made it really easy by creating this marketplace. It created a lot of opportunity for small companies like us. And it continues to create opportunities. Just last week, Cary-based Epic Games, creators of the popular Gears of War PC game franchise, announced that six of its senior developers were spinning off to form their own independent project, BitMonster, set to unveil its first game app, Lily, in August. BitMonster founder Lee Perry says the mobile platform is a low-cost way to get started without having to take on investors. Somebody can just go, make something, put it out on those platforms, Perry says. You don't need a huge distribution network of people. He calls the Apple Store a great equalizer, noting that there's no real way to advertise there and bump ahead of competitors. It evens the playing field for small developers, he says. The market is much more of a meritocracy than it previously has ever been. And he's not fazed by the cheap price tags on mobile games. It's just straight-up numbers, he says. Even though the games are really inexpensive, those little impulse purchases are what drives the entire app economy. A list compiled by Austin puts the number of game studios and publishers with a Triangle presence at 34. Gaming's biggest employers in the Triangle include console companies Epic and Red Storm, each with about 150 employees. He puts the number of employees at area gaming companies at more than 500. Switching to apps worked out for one of Perry's former colleagues at Epic. Programmer Amit Mahajan used to talk about his simple game idea at the water cooler. We were like, yeah, sure, Perry remembers. Mahajan left Epic in 2007 and helped develop a game called Farmville, produced by a public company called Zynga. Farmville was the number one game on Facebook in terms of average daily users between August 2009 and December 2010. So, it can work, Perry says. And our next article on this page is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. And this article has the headline, from $171 million, Raleigh fund crashes at zero. And underneath this article, there's a picture of a man casually dressed, holding a basketball and a glass of wine. The caption reads, Mark Carigliano co-founded Bell Tower. Bell Tower Advisors, a homegrown hedge fund that borrows its name from the iconic clock structure on the UNC Chapel Hill campus, has shuttered its doors. Co-founder Mark Carigliano, who now teaches graduate courses at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School, confirmed the closure. We had one large client that decided to reallocate, says Carigliano, declining to identify the client. At its launch in 2009, Carigliano's had said that an unnamed foundation was one of Bell Tower's largest investors. That organization's decision to pull its money left the head shop with insufficient scale to continue operations, he says now. As of March 2011, Bell Tower reported to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that it had stock holdings of $171 million. In the firm's latest 2012 filing, that figure was revised to zero. At its height, the hedge operation had a small staff of about half a dozen. Named for the Bell Tower were Carigliano and his partners, Kevin Nicholson and Dennis Greenway, received their MBAs. The firm traded in energy, mining, basic materials, and utility stocks. Carigliano says the firm's long-term returns had been strong, but that, like the industry as a whole, 2011 had been a down year. Nationally, about 775 hedge funds shut their doors and liquidated in 2011. About 40% of them are stock traders, according to HedgeWeek's Simon Gray. Hedge funds are unregulated pots of private investor dollars that use a range of sophisticated trading strategies to obtain a return. Outside of a couple of startups, Bell Tower's departure leaves Shaw Capital and Hatteras Funds as Raleigh's premier hedge operations. Among the players in Chapel Hill are Mark Yusko's Morgan Creek Capital and Elliot Boson's Silverback Asset Management. The Southeast as a whole is home to only about 200 active hedge fund managers, estimates Gilbert Davis, co-director of the Atlanta-based Southeastern Hedge Fund Association. Asked if he planned to re-enter the field, Carigliano says he is busy considering his options. NetApp Master Plan shows potential of 4,500 more jobs. This article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. And there's also a picture of a man casually dressed inside the article. The caption reads, Mark Skiff oversees NetApp's Triangle operations. The 460 new jobs announced by NetApp on July 23 could be just the beginning of an expansion that could create tenfold that number of jobs on its local campus. Sunnyvale, California-based NetApp, which now employs more than 1,400 at its Research Triangle Park facilities, has enough land for the construction of four additional buildings that would have room for 4,000 to 4,500 additional employees, a fact confirmed by both Denise Cox, Senior Vice President of Global Support for NetApp, and Mark Skiff, NetApp Site Director. In fact, such a scenario is in writing. The plan announced July 23 to build a new data center is part of a master plan that, if fully realized, would bring a total of four additional buildings, the data center being the first, to a 78-acre tract of already secured land across the street from NetApp's current four-building operation. The initial 460 hires will work in a third building NetApp opened earlier this year on its already established campus, Cox says. But it's not impossible that we would continue to grow, she says, adding that there have been conversations about how many people the full plan could accommodate. Skiff says that each of the conceived office buildings on the uninhabited tract would have five stories at about 245,000 square feet each. But right now the focus is really on the data center, he says. Cox cautions that for now the only definitive hires are the 460, but she does say the RTP site is commonly known as a growth site for NetApp. The new hires will be a combination of researchers and developers of both software and hardware and customer support personnel. Gartner analyst Dave Russell says further growth is expected if NetApp can adapt to its changing customer base. Customers are increasingly looking to bundles for their storage needs, similar to the vBlock, which is marketed by VCE, a Texas-based collaboration among Palo Alto, California-based VMware, San Jose-based Cisco Systems, and NetApp's main competitor, Boston-based EMC Corporation. VCE is selling packaged IT, employing VMware virtualization, Cisco servers, and EMC storage. Russell says the big three players, Palo Alto, California-based HP, Armonk, New York-based IBM, and Round Rock, Texas-based Dell all have packaging capabilities due to recent acquisitions. They've got the ability to combat NetApp, but also to change the buying behavior, he says. To counteract, NetApp is offering a product similar to vBlock with its FlexPod package. More than 50% of FlexPods offer VMware products along with Cisco infrastructure. The main difference between FlexPods and vBlocks are that FlexPods swap out the EMC storage for NetApp, he says. While most storage is still being sold as a single unit, bundles are an increasing player, Russell says, adding that EMC is the current leader in storage. It's a land of co-opetition, he says, alluding to the fact that even NetApp partners such as IBM are putting together competing packages. NetApp has been growing at a torrid pace straight into the teeth of the recession. Revenue grew from $3.9 billion in the fiscal year ended April 2010 to $6.2 billion for the 2012 fiscal year. But in the highly competitive sector in which NetApp operates, margins feel the squeeze, with net income growing from $400 million in 2010 to $605 million in 2012. The $75 million NetApp expansion at RTP announced July 23 was made possible in part by a job development investment grant from the state. NetApp could get as much as $11.78 million in benefits should it meet the targets. The data center itself will utilize the same team of consultants responsible for NetApp's first RTP data center built 3 years ago, CRB in Cary. The architectural interior design contract was awarded to Durham-based O'Brien Atkins. SCIF calls the plans siblings to those for the previous building, saying they are very similar. And as we continue reading the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. First, the nonprofit news. One doesn't expect to call for a tow and have a pink tow truck show up. Sometimes that happens if East Coast Towing in Raleigh is called. A dollar from each tow from the pink ribbon-covered truck from April through June was donated to the Pretty in Pink Foundation, which provides financial support for cancer-related treatments. The total raised by the truck was $2,614. The Lucy Daniel Center and Safe Child have formalized their agreement to work together on projects of mutual interest in their shared goal of eliminating child abuse by helping adults and children create nurturing environments free from abuse and neglect. A centerpiece of this agreement allows these two early childhood organizations to refer families to and connect them with one another's services as appropriate. Raleigh-based Passage Home has received a Department of Veterans Affairs grant worth $153,437 to fight homelessness among low-income veterans. The faith-based nonprofit has been working to fight poverty and homelessness in the Raleigh region since 1991. Passage Home provides a one-year housing stipend and case management services to homeless veterans with dependents, transitioning them from homelessness to permanent housing and helping them achieve financial independence and security. And now we have the Philanthropy News Desk column written by Todd Cohen. The headline on it, Duke Pledges to Continue Philanthropy Here. And there's a large picture of a man wearing a shirt and tie. Inside the article, the caption reads, Richard Stick Williams heads the Duke Energy Foundation. The level of corporate philanthropy at Duke Energy, which merged with Progress Energy effective July 2, will not shrink from the combined support the two companies have been providing in the communities they serve, and its philanthropy will continue to focus on the social needs the two companies have been addressing, the head of the Duke Energy Foundation says. The overall focus will continue to be building strong communities, says Richard Stick Williams, president of the Duke Energy Foundation. In North Carolina, annual philanthropic giving in 2011 totaled $8.5 million at Duke Energy and $4.7 million at Progress Energy, he says, with Duke Energy giving a total of $33 million a year throughout its entire service area, and Progress Energy giving a total of nearly $9 million throughout its entire service area. In documents they filed with the North Carolina Utilities Commission, he says, they agreed to maintain their combined giving over the next 4 years at $16 million to $17 million, or a total of $65 million to $66 million. In addition to philanthropic dollars, both companies encouraged their employees to volunteer and donate to charity, and they provided corporate support to sponsor charitable events. In 2011, Duke Energy employees and retirees contributed more than 200,000 volunteer hours worth $4.4 million, while Progress Energy employees and retirees also were actively engaged in community initiatives. The company did not track total volunteer hours or the dollar value of those hours. As part of their philanthropic giving, both companies offer programs that match charitable contributions by employees. For each employee, for example, Duke agrees to match up to $5,000 a year in giving, dollar for dollar, for giving to education, and 50 cents on the dollar for giving to other causes. The corporate match totals about $1.2 million a year, a total that is included in the company's overall philanthropic giving. Progress Energy has given about $1.1 million a year in matching support during its annual employee giving campaign. Williams says, while the two corporate foundations will not merge until January 1, Williams says the goal is for each foundation to continue focusing on the causes it has supported in the past. All those causes have focused on community vitality, he says, including support for nonprofits that work in the areas of human services, economic development, the environment, pre-kindergarten through high school education, and higher education. That will not change, Williams says. And in the region that Progress Energy served, he says, his goal over the next several years is to continue to focus on things Progress has considered to be important. Alyssa McDonald, vice president of the Duke Energy Foundation, says both companies provided significant financial support to similar organizations in the Triangle. Both companies, for example, have funded the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, the Advanced Transportation Energy Center at North Carolina State University, and the College of Engineering at NC State. It's part of the DNA of Duke Energy, Williams says, to be very engaged in the communities and be very supportive of the communities we serve. And now the People on the Move section. Diane Bordley Suber, president of St. Augustine's College, and Farad Ali, senior vice president of the North Carolina Institute of Minority Economic Development, have been named to the United Way of the Greater Triangle's Board of Directors. The Rex Healthcare Foundation named Amy Daniels executive director. She was promoted from her position as manager of foundation operations. In her new role, Daniels will have responsibility for all foundation activities and oversee a staff of 7 people. Kyle Prairie of the Carolina Hurricanes was named chairman of Marble's Kids Museum's Board of Directors for 2012 to 2013. Senior Pharma Assist, a nonprofit medication assistance and Medicare insurance counseling program in Durham, named Tawana Bazemore, David Cachetto, and Carolyn Titus to 3-year terms on its board of directors. And returning to full-length articles, the next one's written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Durham. The headline, California Beauty Products Concern Picks Site in Durham. Hatch Beauty buys old Pharma Lab where it will manufacture with up to 75 employees. And also there's a picture at the outside of a building. The caption reads, Hatch Beauty now owns this building in Durham. Hatch Beauty, a California company that develops beauty products for retailers including The Gap, CVS, and Bath & Body Works, is moving its manufacturing operations cross-country after acquiring a pharmaceutical lab company and building in Durham. Hatch Beauty employs 42 people in Southern California, and the company estimates it will eventually have 50 to 75 employees at its Durham operations, depending on the complexity of projects it is running. The facility will have the capability to produce products on a large scale and small scale basis. The privately owned company's annual revenue has been estimated at between $30 million and $50 million. Hatch Beauty is making the transition after buying the assets of Gorbeck Pharmaceutical Laboratory, as well as the pharmaceutical grade laboratory and filling station where Gorbeck operated since 2007 at 2445 South Alston Avenue in Durham. Hatch Beauty managing partner Tracy Holland would not disclose how much the company paid for Gorbeck, the company, but Durham County records show that Hatch Beauty paid $2.1 million for the building that was owned by Gorbeck founder Michael Gorman. Our California team is over there now, and once they get back, we'll be able to put together a plan for hiring and startup, Holland says. She estimates production will be operational within a month. Holland would not comment on whether Hatch Beauty would be hiring Gorbeck's former staff, and Gorman did not return calls for comment. The building had been listed for sale for $3.5 million by Dan Thompson, formerly of the Cassidy Turley real estate firm in Raleigh, but Thompson declined to comment and referred questions to Gorman. He noted that the bank had control of the property at the time it was sold. Durham records show that BB&T Bank had appointed a substitute trustee to oversee the assets in December. Holland says it was both the 35,000-square-foot laboratory building's immediate functionality and the Triangle's talented workforce, particularly for companies involved in complex chemical research and beauty product expertise, that attracted her attention and that of her business partner, Ben Bennett. Hatch Beauty has been using contract manufacturers in California to produce the skin lotions, hair products, and fragrances for its roster of beauty brands and retailers. This was our next step, Holland says. The intent is to make us a more vertical organization so we can provide our own finished product. Hatch Beauty will become part of a growing cluster of similar companies in Durham, which is the headquarters of Burt's Bees, an earth-friendly skincare, cosmetics, and personal products company owned by Clorox. The region is also home to fragrance maker Cody's Incorporated's largest U.S. production plant in Lee County, as well as cosmetics maker Revlon's largest manufacturing plant in Granville County. The Body Shop operates a corporate office and distribution facility in Wake Forest. We decided to relocate our manufacturing because we could tap into that talent pool, where we could find chemists and research talent for topical skin care, which is what we do, Holland says. Based in Santa Monica, California, Holland and Bennett merged their companies in 2009 to become Hatch Beauty Agency, LLC, and Hatch Beauty Products, LLC. The Durham facility will be the base for a third company under similar ownership called Hatch Beauty Labs, LLC. Lee Ann Nance, Senior Vice President for the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, describes Hatch Beauty as really like a life science company. It's a beauty industry company, but they operate like a life science company. It's an interesting cross-pollination. She calls it a good fit for the region. Gorbeck faces a lawsuit filed by Rivers Edge Pharmaceuticals, LLC of Sewanee, Georgia, alleging a breach of contract and fiduciary duty, misappropriation of trade secrets, and other charges. Gorbeck and Gorman filed a countersuit. The suit is pending. And our next article in the Triangle Business Journal has the headline, Cowell, Halliburton, Devon, Nike should disclose giving. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. Shoemaker Nike isn't the only corporate giant that North Carolina pension officials, led by Treasury Secretary Janet Cowell, want to see release detailed information about their political contributions. Add two other companies to the list, Oklahoma City-based Devon Energy and Houston-based Halliburton. Pension fund spokeswoman Julia Vale says the agency has signed letters asking both firms to provide full disclosure of political spending, including contributions made to 527s and trade associations. The 527s are tax-exempt groups that raise cash and place ads about political issues but aren't supposed to endorse specific candidates. Vail says Cowell and other pension officials are also backing an appeal to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that the regulatory agency develop rules requiring disclosure of political spending. As for Beaverton, Oregon-based Nike, North Carolina officials are pushing for a shareholder vote on the company's latest proxy that would require the athletic apparel giant to disclose contributions. The Nike board has asked shareholders to vote no on the provision. With a total of $75 billion invested, the North Carolina pension fund holds 587,813 Class B Nike shares, but it has not released the nature of its stake in Devon or Halliburton. The proxy proposal for Nike is part of a larger strategy to encourage companies involved in political activities to disclose their political spending and board oversight policies to make sure that these expenses are in the best interest of shareholders, Vail says. Shareholder activism in the political spending area has taken on added urgency since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down barriers to corporate giving in the 2010 Citizens United case. The North Carolina Nike shareholder proposal is one of 109 filed in 2012 that aimed to throw more light on the political spending habits of major corporations. That's twice the number that was filed 3 years ago, says Heidi Welsh of the Boonesboro, Maryland-based Sustainable Investment Institute. Fortune 500 companies spent $1.1 billion in 2010, the year of the Citizens United ruling, on lobbying state-level races and political action committees, according to that same institute. Corporations differ on how much they like to reveal about political spending and participation, and the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Political Accountability, CPA, rates their performance. Nike, Devon, and Halliburton, the trio of firms that has come under scrutiny by North Carolina pension officials, ranked at the bottom of CPA's latest disclosure performance index for major U.S. corporations, says Center Director Bruce Freed. And in the Spotlight on Technology in the Triangle Business Journal, there's an article written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, at NCSU, work on faster processors. And there's also a picture of a gentleman casually dressed sitting at a desk with some diagrams in front of him. The caption reads, Eric Rotenberg leads work on core processors. Software being developed at NC State University could mean better and faster processors, an innovation that doesn't stop at PCs. Lead scientist Eric Rotenberg says he sees his National Science Foundation-funded program, FabScaler, leading to a world where smartphones have longer battery lives and companies can create computer hardware themselves to meet their particular needs, even if they don't employ doctorates in engineering. It can happen, but it's complicated, Rotenberg says, and it's breaking through that complication that could mean a payday for the science and scientists. FabScaler is supported by two separate National Science Foundation grants totaling a combined $750,000. Additionally, Intel and IBM have issued grants of $200,000 and $20,000, respectively, for Rotenberg's research. To understand the technology, one has to grasp the fact that the central processing unit, dubbed the brain of a computer, is made up of smaller processors. To illustrate, UNC Chapel Hill computer science professor Jan Prinz cited Legos, the plastic building game toy. There are a lot of plastic pieces, and they'll all build something, but specialty pieces, the particular Legos that aren't just rectangular, they can create art, and efficiently. You can build something that uses less plastic with that particular Lego, Prinz says. Less plastic and a unique design, the difference between a big Lego box and a Lego Death Star. The special Lego equates to a customized computer core. Cores enable software programs to function, and multiple cores on chips make up multiple core processors. Typically, those cores are virtual copies of each other, able to fill a general purpose. A growing trend, however, puts the special Legos in play. Customizable cores better equipped for a particular function, whether it's to play games on a mobile phone or interpret graphics on a PC. General purpose works, but customizable is better. By having heterogeneous cores, you're able to most efficiently process the code, says Charlene Marini, a vice president at one of the leading core manufacturers, ARM Incorporated. The application runs on the core most suited to characteristics of the application, Rotenberg clarifies. Each core takes dozens of researchers and possibly years to configure, design, and test, however. And that's where FabScaler comes in, making that process faster and more accessible to those who understand Legos better than processors. FabScaler allows anyone to enter in architecture specifications. The program then automates designs of computer cores specifically for the customer, cutting core design from years to minutes. Niket Chowdhury, lead PhD student on the five-year NCSU project, says more than 100 researchers are already using the in-progress tool for their own research. They're using it to do analysis, solve power consumption issues, Chowdhury says, but the caveats are huge. Not only does the physical design effort have to be addressed, but the cores will be too simple for some complex processors. But application processors that are found in phones, tablets, and other communication computing devices are lower performance and prime candidates. ARM has already created a mobile core system in which a large core and a small core work together. The small core is sufficient for most functions and saves energy, thus improving battery life, Marini says. While she's not familiar with Rotenberg's work, she says technology that would help you implement those in a faster way would benefit. Rotenberg's next step is working on a computer language for the software that he can license. After that comes copywriting and then a lot more research, but companies are already starting to talk. And now we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. NetApp adding 460 new jobs in RTP. Data management company NetApp plans to create 460 new jobs over 4 years and invest more than $75 million into a new R&D facility in Research Triangle Park. Compensation for workers at the new data center will vary by job function, but the average annual compensation for the new positions will be $100,000 plus benefits. The average annual wage in Wake County is $45,396. As part of the expansion, the state has awarded a job development investment grant that could yield as much as $11.78 million in incentives for the company. Headquartered in California, NetApp employs more than 12,000 individuals in more than 170 offices worldwide, including more than 1,400 employees in its RTP facility. Lenovo kicks off sponsorship with NFL. Chinese computer maker Lenovo, which has its executive headquarters in the Triangle, officially announced a partnership with the NFL today, making it the exclusive sponsor for desktops, laptops, and workstations. Tablet computers are not included in the deal. Financial details for the three-year deal were not disclosed, but the sponsorship is the largest ever for the company in North America and the second largest behind only the sponsorship for the Beijing Olympics, according to company spokeswoman Milanka Miuki. There were a few specifics about the deal that were available Wednesday, but Lenovo will receive advertising space in venues and at NFL events and be allowed to use the NFL logo on its products or in its ads. There will also be more Lenovo commercials during NFL games, where Lenovo will push its Ultrabook and its new slogan, "For Those Who Do." Film industry generating $300 million in North Carolina spending. Halfway through the 2012 calendar year, film productions in North Carolina have already eclipsed 2011's record-setting numbers for in-state spending, according to a news release issued by Governor Beverly Perdue's office Wednesday. As of July, the North Carolina Film Office says that more than 35 productions are filming in the state this year. The projects are expected to spend more than $300 million while creating 15,000-plus jobs, including more than 3,300 crew positions for the state's skilled film professional workforce. Production has taken place or is scheduled to take place in 30 of the state's 100 counties so far this year, with highlights including Iron Man 3, Safe Haven, and We're the Millers. Is General Parts looking to sell CarQuest for $2 billion? Raleigh-based General Parts International has hired Wells Fargo to help it explore the option of selling off the retail store chain CarQuest, according to a report from MSN Money. The media outlet says such a sale could be worth $2 billion. General Parts owns about 1,400 of Carquest's 3,400 stores across North America. SideQuest Incorporated paying $22 million for Canadian tech company. Kerry-based SideQuest Incorporated is acquiring Canadian management software company Upside Software Incorporated for $22 million. SideQuest will use Upside's platform to expand its source-to-settle solution suite. SideQuest CEO Stephen Wiebe says, "This acquisition deepens our offerings in contract lifecycle management," he adds. Upside, based in Edmonton, Alberta, is expected to contribute about $5 million in revenue for the rest of the year and $15 million for the full year in 2013. Upside has more than 100 customers. And in our remaining minute, we'll read a little bit of the Washington Briefs by Kent Hoover. Internet tax momentum builds. Traditional retailers heard some magic words at a House hearing July 24. Tax-free sales on the Internet may be coming to an end, says Representative John Conyers, Democrat from Michigan. At issue is whether Congress should pass legislation such as the Marketplace Equity Act that would allow states to start collecting sales taxes on online purchases. Under current law, online retailers have to collect sales taxes only if they have a physical presence in the state where the customer resides. Otherwise, customers are supposed to pay taxes on their online purchases directly to their states, but that hardly ever happens. Brick-and-mortar retailers have long complained that the tax-free status of e-commerce gives Internet retailers an unfair price advantage. As more retail sales move toward the Internet, state and local governments are increasingly feeling the loss of sales tax revenue. Even many Republican governors who favor keeping taxes low now think the time has come to force Internet retailers to collect sales taxes. One of those governors is Bill Haslam of Tennessee, who estimates Tennessee alone loses about $400 million a year in sales taxes that go uncollected on Internet purchases. And we'll stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.